Hello, and welcome to the 17th Millennial 2016 Hangout, and this is with Black Pigeon Speaks. Black Pigeon, welcome to the channel.
Thank you very much, Millennial, or woes, as I should say.
Yeah. Okay, I'll just introduce you. Obviously, most people will have heard of you. Black Pigeon started earlier this year. What time, when was it? Was it in January this year?
Yeah, I started January. Just pretty much my first video was a response to the mass sexual assaults in Cologne that happened in January of last year. And that was the first video I made on my channel. And just my rather disgust at what happened and also the authorities and their handling of it. So, yeah. It's been almost 1 year.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that was how you started with a video about that, because I remember seeing it at the time, but I'd forgotten that was your first video. I've also done a series about Cologne. I wanted to finish it this year, but because I thought that's the same thing to do, but it takes time for me to sort of distill ideas, and in the end, December's just been just chock-a-block for me, so I wasn't able to finish it this year. It's really annoying. But there are different aspects to it. I mean, I think that series was about 15 videos or something like that. Because it is it's an intensely depressing event. And not the event itself, because you know it could have been completely avoided. But then also
it was a brought on event that anyone with eyes, ears, and half a wit could see coming.
Yeah, and it was almost constructed. I mean, it was constructed by state, perhaps unwittingly, but it was constructed by state maneuvers, by their actions. Mm. So that's the first depressing thing about it. And then obviously the second is the reaction to it, which was, I mean, the German media buried it for, was it 3 days?
Well, they first tried to hide it. Yeah, they first tried to hide it. And then afterward, they tried to minimize it. And then you also had, I mean, there's people that have said that it was Soros-funded, George Soros-funded groups that were giving money toward. But there was also women, you know, once it became known, there were women in Cologne that were walking around on the streets in large groups handing out flowers to these migrants that had sexually assaulted the women. So, you know, it was not only watching and reading about massive groups of women that were sexually molested and assaulted by these enrichers, as I guess we should call them, but then afterwards there was German women thanking them for their enrichment. And I mean, one of the reasons it came home to me is one of the first countries I ever lived when I was young abroad was Germany. I did a year of university in Frankfurt, and my first girlfriend or my first love or whatever, she was German, and she actually had some friends she lives fairly near Cologne, and she had some friends there, and the whole episode was highly depressing. So.
Well, it is. It really is, because you get the sense that I'm sorry to plug my own stuff again, but one of the videos in the Cologne series was called Cologne and the German Elite. And it's just, it was the most depressing video I've ever made, and it was difficult to make it, because you see that at every level of German society, there is self-hate, and like really active, it's not even passive or latent, it's active self-hate. They're actively working to destroy their society, and by that I mean they're to destroy their people, their group, and that's what's just so awful about it. I mean, they're convinced that they don't deserve to exist.
No, I would agree with that. And the funny thing is I think, I mean, I, you know, where I am now located, it's also one of the Axis powers that were defeated in the Second World War, and it's interesting to see the difference in. I don't know if you can subscribe it to Christian guilt versus, you know, Buddhism, Stoicism, but you know, in where I am now, these people on, for example, on the 23rd of December, a few days ago, it's the Emperor's birthday, and you have these black cars with, you know, festooned with the rising sun, and loudspeakers driving up and down streets, squealing, you know, about the supremacy of the Japan and their emperor, and having no guilt whatsoever for attacking China and enslaving Korean women and whatever they're accused of. Whereas the Germans have pretty much, as you just said, they're active in their own desire to not exist. It's very, 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 very depressing, to tell you the truth. It's very depressing. You know, even talking to my old girlfriend just recently, and I was asking her about these things, you know, and she was, you know, yeah, but it's not so bad in the village I'm living in. So, you know, we have to at least try to make it work. And just, yeah, okay.
But why? I mean, this is the question, you know, why, what's in it for us? What's in it for, in this case, what's in it for the Germans? Why do you have to suffer this? Why do you have to cut off that limb? You know,
well, exactly. Yeah, I'm not going to argue with you. I think you and I just keep asking each other why.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy. Yeah, but this is the question that never arises. Why must Europe undergo this incredible transformation, this unprecedented, radical, drastic, earth-shattering transformation? Why must that happen?
I mean, no, I agree. And the thing is, well, that's a very good question. What does, you know, your average European, and a better question is what does their posterity gain from this radical transformation that's happening via choice? There's no army. Well, there is an army standing, an army of people, but this is not a conquering with guns and swords and tanks. It's just a demographic swamping of an entire continent of people.
Yeah, it's a conquering of guilt and self-hate.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think, I can't imagine this ever, I can't even think of any sort of historical precedent for this other than, I mean, there's people try to draw, you know, equivalents to the fall of the Roman Empire, but I don't even think that would be similar, because everything I read, William Gibbons, the fall of the Roman Empire and the Romans that were, at least at that time, they weren't happy about the barbarians, you know, being given land within the empire. They weren't happy about them, you know, taking on and pretending as though that they were Roman. But now, I mean, you know, you can be, you know, anybody from anywhere, and you come to let's say, you know, Scotland or the UK, and you stay for 2 or 3 years, and then you say, well, I'm not that nationality, but you also have to respect my culture and my, you know, my way of thinking and my life, and therefore this is the way it's going to be. So yeah, it's a very, very interesting time to be alive.
Well, on that note, let's reel back a bit and talk about
your
channel.
Yes. Yes, of course.
Begin with by talking about for a start. So it started with the Cologne video.
Yes.
But prior to that, how long had you been thinking about doing a channel like this?
Probably years. I've always been obviously somewhat politically oriented. And it was mostly just talking with friends or with, you know, people that I know about, you know, these kinds of things. The problem is where I grew up and most of the people I know are very much politically to the far left. Most of the men I know as well. I mean, it's not just the women. And there was never really anybody except perhaps my younger brother. He's probably the only one I could talk to. And my older brother as well. Were the only people I could ever talk to about issues like this. So, insofar as just making a channel like this, yeah, it's probably been on the back burner for years. And it was just when the whole migrant crisis started and then the massive problems that happened in Cologne, it was just like, God damn it, I have to at least give my piece. I never really thought a channel would come of it, to tell you the truth. I just threw it up because I was just needing to vent for most.
But a channel My channel certainly did come of it. I mean, this is the remarkable story of your channel. You've got, yeah, and I'm not saying this just to be a sycophant, but it is a remarkable story. You've got 141,000 subscribers just now. Which is less than a year. And you know, I mean, I don't know. There are probably very lightweight channels, you know, kitten videos that get those kind of numbers. But for something with this sort of subject matter, that is a real achievement.
Yeah, to tell you the truth, you know, a lot of people have asked me about that, and I really don't know, to tell you the truth. I don't know why. I mean, I made the first couple of videos out of just wanting to vent my own frustration at the situation. As I said, you know, I do have personal ties to Germany. I've got a lot of personal ties to Europe. I mean, even you know, my own mother, she's from your country. Well, not your country, from the country down south from where you are, and a lot of cousins and family members and people. And it just, you know, it just began as a rant, just wanting to get things off my own chest that nobody other than my older brother and my younger brother would actually listen to. So,
right. It's a similar thing. Really. I started mine because in my real life, you know, I didn't have anyone around me that would listen to it and would listen to it in the volume that I wanted to rant about it. So I had to, you know, it was a sort of natural decision to make, really.
Yeah. So yeah, it's, I think, kind of the same thing. I mean, and then my channel just kind of came of that. It wasn't really planned, at all. I mean, I obviously I know how to edit and make videos. I mean, looking at some of the comments in the chat, and there's always the question, and I'll just throw it up. People are always like, well, who's behind you? Who's backing you? Who's paying for all this? Nobody's paying for it. I know how to do these things. It's just, it's me. I know how to put videos together. It's not, some secret cabal of elves that are assisting me. It's just me. I know how to make these things. It's strange how it's grown. I never actually expected that, to be honest with you.
But you did fashion the videos to be accessible. I mean, they're very concise.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, I mean, I went to university. I know how to write. I know how to tell a story. I know how to put things together. Just also through jobs, employment, work, you know, businesses that I've had, I kind of understand how to, you know, put things together, tell a story, and tell it, you know, as you, the word you used, concise. So, you know, these are, you know, things that I already brought to the table. They weren't things I was learning on the spot. So
I think one thing people would probably like to know is where did the name come from?
Well, the name. Well, it's, there's two reasons. Well, I mean, I'll tell you the most obvious. The most obvious is I went to India in 2011, and I got bit on the ankle by I'm not even exactly sure what it was, but it caused me to become very, 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 very ill, and I spent about 6 months in hospital because of it. I actually, not in India, because I probably would have died in India. I ended up being able to get back to Bangkok, then Hong Kong, and then Tokyo, and I spent 6 months in hospital. And while I did, I couldn't really go anywhere. It was actually more than 6 months. And there was a small park outside of the hospital I was staying at. And I used to go out and hang out with the birds is when I first met them. And I started to just get to know, you know, pigeons. I mean, I was pretty sick, and to be honest, I wasn't sure whether I was going to make it. And you, there's a lot of self-reflection that goes through your mind at times like that. And I ended up spending time a lot in this park with my, you know, my IV drip and my pajamas. And I started talking to these pigeons, and I started just getting to know them. And then after I got out, I kept going back and feeding them. And I got to know them. I mean, the thing is people will call you a cuck, or they'll make fun of you for X, Y, and Z by saying, you know, you're weak or you're, you know, the thing is that what it was is that I realized that these birds were, they're very gentle spirits. There's a reason why the dove is God's bird, the symbol of peace. There's a reason why these birds have been equated with humans since, you know, biblical times. And for example, if you go to St. Peter's Cathedral in the Vatican, right behind the altar is a massive stained glass window of a big pigeon. And the reason is they were domesticated by us, and they're very different. Like, most people think they're like seagulls or crows, or they're like other ones. What they're not. They each and every single one of them is laid. They're like dogs. They like to play. They have very individual personalities. At the moment, I have three in my house. I've got one that's really shy. The reason they're in my house is I and there's another reason, coming back to my channel's name, is I basically rescue these birds from the street if they're in peril of dying. So one of the ones, the three I have, one had a broken wing, and I met him at a train station, and he was just flapping around with a broken wing. Another one I met was mauled by a crow, and the crow was about to eat him, and I shooed the crow away, and it was a baby at the time. And the third one was a baby that fell out of the nest, so I kind of nursed it from, I had to milk it and make this fake nipple, not nipple, but fake, I don't know, bottle and stuff. And anyway, so I gained a large appreciation for you know, life and birds. And the other reason is that pigeons have always been the bringer of messages. You know, prior to telecommunications, they were used throughout the world as messengers, and they were used even up until the First World War. There's a few pigeons that were given medals of bravery
carrier pigeons.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, and the thing is the black, because black is, I mean, we're living in black times, right? So black pigeon, it's basically the idea is I'm bringing messages that maybe a lot of people don't want to hear, but they might be at least I feel that they're important. And yes, I'm a pigeon aficionado. You know, people will just laugh or they'll make fun of it, but I mean, you know, fuck it. I mean, people like dogs. So,
I see.
I've always been an animal lover. And that, you know, that I'm also a vegetarian, which people also say you're a cuck or you're a low testosterone, whatever, you know, I don't really care. I've always been an animal lover. So, I mean, so it doesn't, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's fine. One thing I'm curious about is, how do you make the videos? What are the skills that are involved? I think other people have been curious about this. What tools do you use?
It's very easy. It's three tools. And they're all Adobe. It's Photoshop to basically dress any kind of photographs or images that I use. And there's Adobe After Effects, which is the After Effects is for the animations, right? So if you want to animate things, I mean, that's what I use to rotate, you know, make a photograph and I make it into 3D, for example. And then just Premiere to edit it all together. It's three programs.
Yeah, I was wondering about the thing where you make 2D photos into, they rotate in 3D. How do you do that?
Yeah, it's just After Effects. It's you take the photograph and you just set it up, and then I don't know, you give it depth and you set it, and then you just slowly rotate it by giving it. It's you're not rotating it. What you're doing is you're giving it a close up to you're bringing it closer and moving it further away. So it looks like it's rotating, but it's not really rotating. You're just moving it closer and further away. Is what it is.
Right. I think I understand. That's very impressive. I've often wondered how it was done.
It's a trick. It's not rotating. You're just giving depth to the photograph, and then you're moving it in closer and moving it in further away. It's not actually, it looks like it's rotating, but it's not really.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's, we've spoken about cologne. So let's talk about, the general European situation, because I think, I mean, your channel, you do talk about things that affect the entire West, like the trans issue and that kind of thing. But I think your focus does seem to be on Europe rather than America or Canada. Or Australia.
Well, I do give a lot of lip service to Canada, but most of it not good. And it's funny because I get a lot of shit from subscribers telling me that I have some sort of unnatural hatred for Canada, and you know, I've got mental problems because of it, because of my pathological, as they say, pathological dislike for Justin, the former substitute drama teacher Trudeau. But yeah, I do focus a lot on Europe. Yeah.
Sorry about that. And is that because of your ancestral connections with Europe, or is it because you see Europe as something more important than the new
both.
World?
It's both. I think that if one of them has to be, both of them are on a trajectory to oblivion, I would say. Both of them are on trajectory to oblivion. But the thing is that if one of them had to be saved, it has to be Europe, in my opinion. Because, you know, once Europe is gone, it's gone. I mean, it would be the same thing as if, you know, if you had to save either, you know, Brazil, which has a huge number of Japanese people, or you had to save Japan from being destroyed. Well, you'd probably want to save Japan. I don't think, just from my own experience, I don't think a country like Canada is actually, you know, I mean, I'm going to get a lot of shit for saying this, but I don't think Canada is savable at this point. It's, you know, you see a lot of people that are, you know, trying. There's the, I'm looking at the comments as we're speaking with the Echo, Lauren Southern, and, you know, Rebel Media and whatnot. They're doing their best, I guess, but the mindset that you have to work against in a country like Canada is just, it's just too overwhelming, and the brainwashing is too strong. And, it's also my ancestral connections. I mean, and just my own, I mean, I've spent a good portion of my life living in Europe as well. So it's not somewhere I'm unfamiliar with. So yeah, I do spend probably an inordinate amount of time in Europe, but like you said, my channel is more, it's like yours as well, it's more global than it is local.
But tell me about Canada. Why do you think Canada is beyond saving?
It's a long conversation, but I think one thing I should say, because a lot of people wonder about my nationality, and I never really understood or even knew that I have a strange accent. People constantly go on about I have a very strange accent. I think that's because I'm from Canada, but also I've also lived abroad for so many years that I've probably picked up a lot of linguistic tics from other people. Canada is a country that it's Belgium on the North American continent. It's a country that always had a problem with itself. So one thing that's very interesting about Canada was confederated in 1867 on the island of Prince Edward Island. So Prince Edward Island. And the funny part was it was confederated with several of the provinces that surrounded it, but Prince Edward Island was still a crown colony, as was Newfoundland was a crown colony up until 1949. But it was, Canada was confederated on an island that didn't join Confederation. So the country was born in a territory that didn't want to be part of it. And then you also had the inclusion of French Canadians. And it's always been a house divided culturally, linguistically, and it's always been a country that's had a hard time defining itself, because it's also been next to pretty much the economic and cultural juggernaut that is the United States. And one of the things that it's always done, and I highlight this in my videos to the detriment of my subscriber count, and also to the lambasting I get from fellow Canadians, that Canada has always been a country that tries to define itself as not American. And coming from a base like that, coming from a base of having a really hard time trying to define yourself as a country next to a country like the United States, having, you know, a good quarter to a third of your population being French and not really liking you or wanting to be part of your country, and having, you know, endless referendums on sovereignty. And then, starting in 1965, changing immigration laws, but it didn't really hit until the 1990s. Canada was 95-98% European up until the 90s, and it's dropping by 5-10% every time there's a census. So I think Canada, the level of brainwashing in Canada, Canadians are told that it's the most important thing in the world is to be nice, unassuming, and have really no opinions other than you're nice. So
I heard was some guy proudly saying that Canada doesn't have a culture. Canada's culture is that it's multicultural.
Okay, yeah, that's also this is the which is complete bullshit. Canada's has a culture. It absolutely does, and it has up until again the 1990s been, I would say, pretty much. I've said this before, and it's not meaning to be rude to you because I know you do live in the UK, but I think the true British people are the people that are now the descendants of people that live in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States. These are the people that left the home islands and they pushed the borders of the empire. They were the ones that went out into the wilderness and built a country out of nothing. And in my opinion, these are probably the real British. The people that stayed home on the home islands are the people just were content to do nothing and stay there. And well, so,
but the other side of that, though, is that it was the ones the ones who stayed then did the British Empire.
Well, no, they might have micromanaged it, but they were the ones that were, you know, working in the factory. So I'm talking about the people that pushed the borders of the empire out.
I see what you mean. I thought you meant the pioneers of America and Canada.
No. I'm talking about just. I know this is it's very controversial, but I kind of think that the real British are the people that are the descendants of people that are living in places like Canada, and Canada, you know, it had a very, very British character up until the 1990s. I would say even people that had come from other countries like Germany or Holland or whatever, they, you know, after a generation or two, they embraced the Britishness of Canada. And this whole concept of, oh, Canada doesn't have a culture, this is also propagated by, yet again, and I don't mean to be, I'm not even, because I imagine I'm going to be called autistic, but I always like to slide in that Justin Trudeau was a former substitute drama teacher. But people like him, he's also talked about the fact that he's said that Canada has no core culture anymore, and it is the first post-national country, which means Canada has no culture. Canada's, and they're talking about ramping up immigration to, I don't know, 400,000 per year. And immigration is not intrinsically a bad thing. I mean, when I grew up, there was a few Chinese kids and a few Japanese kids and a few East Indian kids, and we all got along fine, because the thing was, is there was a larger culture that people had to assimilate toward. But what's happening now in Canada, and it's also, you know, things like the internet, telecommunications, television, and these kinds of things, and the sheer size of the numbers of people that are coming in, and also because they're coming in from, you know, less and less, it's not a melting pot so much as it's just large groups of people moving in. Same could probably be said in the UK with Pakistanis, for example. And so what they're doing is they're trying to reorchestrate history by saying that Canada is a country that's never had a culture. We've always been multiculturalism, and that's just hogwash. It's rubbish.
Well, yeah, it's a sort of retrofit. You know, you hear the same thing in Britain. They'll say, well, Britain's always been a nation of immigrants, so as to justify the present situation where we're, you know, giving our country up to immigrants.
Yeah, and this is exactly this is exactly what they're doing in Canada. But the thing is that at least in Canada, you could plausibly say, well, at least, you know, there was the native populations, but in Europe, there is no plausibility to that argument, especially in somewhere like the UK. It's rubbish.
Yeah, it's blatantly dishonest and untrue. Mm. I mean, you can just about get away with saying that about the New World. You can say that, yep, you know, after the initial pioneers and colony, it was lots of immigrants. You know, after the country had been set up, then it was immigrants after that. All right, you can say that, but they were still building the country. I mean, they were still forming its institutions.
There was no country without them.
Yeah, so, you know, they were key to making it, to building it. So even there, I don't think you can say that America is a nation of immigrants. I still, you can say it's technically true, but I think it's still dishonest. However,
it is. I would agree with you on that.
And the same with Canada. And however, when you go to Europe, if you say that any of those countries is a country of immigrants, as a nation of it, I think that is just so, in every way, it's dishonest. There's no way in which it's true. And unless you're focusing upon the last 50 years as indicative of the entire country's history, is it like that? This last 50 years is the only bit that actually matters. And if you're actually saying that, then you could say that Britain's a nation of immigrants. But why the fuck would you do that?
No, I'd agree with you. And actually, I can't remember where I read it or when I read it. It must have been like at least more than a year ago. But there was a study taken on the genetic makeup of the British Isles. And they were talking about, you know, one of the arguments that they always give about we're a nation of immigrants is the Huguenots coming over from France. And they don't, you know, generally ever say it took, you know, it was over a span of 50 years and it was less than 100,000 people, you know, but they try to use that as an example of, well, yes, of course we should be taking in, you know, 20 million people from Afghanistan because, you know, we took in Huguenots in the 16th century or the 17th century. But the thing was, is even through, you know, and then they say, well, you know, London, it was built by the Romans. Of course, we're a country of immigrants. But I read that the genetic makeup of the British Isles hasn't really much changed since the last ice age. So, you know, the like you said, it's rubbish. This thing about UK being a country of immigrants.
It's blatantly dishonest. And, yeah. I mean, even if you could say that, yeah, there was a lot of immigration up until the 19th century, yeah, you can make a case that there were considerable numbers of people. But even those numbers are utterly dwarfed by the numbers today. I mean, these numbers are completely unprecedented. And I actually read that we get more, and I'm not going to, don't quote me on this, but I read this, that we get more people in a year now than immigrated to Britain in the entire 19th century.
I think I've read the exact same thing. So I won't quote you on it, but I think I've read it the exact same thing.
Mm. So
and you've lost your capital city as well. So I mean,
well, there it is. Yes, we have. It's 45%. I can never remember whether it's 45% native or 45% white, which is obviously two different things.
Two different things. I mean, you're talking about the Poles, you know, the Latvians and the
Lithuanians. Yeah, exactly. But even, so that's 45% overall. And remember, that was 5 years ago, so it'll be even worse now. But then you've got to look at the young. And in inner London, it's only, as I've said this many times on my channel, it's one in five school children is white.
Yeah, it's that gone.
Remarkable.
It's gone.
Is gone.
The funny thing is that with regards to that, you know, you've got, I don't even understand how people in the UK haven't revolted against television licensing and the British, the BBC, you know, the Burka Broadcasting Corporation, because the way they try to frame this argument is, if you look on every time that this comes up, they'll say, well, the reason is because it's actually a success story. All of this white flight is actually not white flight. You know, British people would love to live in multicultural and Islamic, you know, highly Islamic neighborhoods, but these people have had found success. So in the last, between this census and the last census, 600,000 people have left London, 600,000 white British people have left London because they've found success and they're moving into bigger houses out in the countryside. You know,
That was Mark Eason. That was a famous article that I talked about at some point by Mark Eason. It was a BBC journalist called Mark Eason, and he did this article where he said that. It was actually a story. The fact that, I remember it was 600,000 white Londoners had left between the 2001 and 2011 census. So in that 10-year period, 600,000 white Londoners left London. Now, obviously, from an alarmist, angry nativist point of view, that's dreadful. It's simply dreadful. But he was saying, no, actually, it's a story of success because they're moving out because they've got more money now.
Yeah, no, exactly. There's another one of these shills is he's a little skinny little cockroach, Owen Wilson. Have you seen this little cockroach? I saw this one thing. There was a phone-in poll, or maybe it was an internet poll, and it was, you know, they were asking their audience, is multiculturalism working in the UK, yes or no? And 95 or something percent.
It was 95% said no. It was amazing.
Oh, you know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah. And then he just sat there smugly going, well, you know, they obviously don't understand. Obviously, he was probably, I don't remember what he said, but he was probably thinking to himself, you know, obviously they don't understand the way I do. You know, they're just, you know, the stupid, you know, plebs, you know,
and the irony is that he's written a book about plebs. It's called Chavs, The Demonization of the Working Class. And yet if there's anyone in Britain who feels superior to the working class, the chavs, the underclass, it's Owen fucking Jones or whatever. It's Owen Jones.
Owen Wilson.
Yeah, he's the actor.
I think that's the guy. That's the guy from Zoolander, I think, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, they're both actors, obviously. Anyway. it was grotesque. And I remember hearing him sort of squirm on that program. It's on YouTube somewhere. It's a classic clip because it's one of those instances where the BBC's worldview is completely trashed and all they can do is flail around pathetically.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that I can't even understand how people haven't risen up and tried to defund that. It's a propaganda arm. And the funny part is the last time I was in London, I was staying in Shepherd's Bush, which is just next to Notting Hill. And right above there is they got a massive, massive BBC compound. I mean, it's like the size of a stadium, and it's in like West London, you know, one of the most expensive places on the planet. And this is supposedly a government corporation, you know. I don't know. I don't even understand. I'm at a loss for words. I'm starting to stutter because it's just the stupidity of it all, you know.
Yeah, I think, there is an argument that the BBC is worth saving simply because of its cultural force, that it would be better to keep it and just, you know, possess it with a new spirit, get rid of all the crap, get rid of all the cucks who infest it now and give it new life and new direction. And the infrastructure that's in place would be very useful to a new Britain, you know, a revived Britain. I think that's true, but I don't think it's very realistic. If things go the way I think they're going to go in Britain, there simply won't be a BBC at the end of it. There won't be large and ultimately frivolous institutions like that anymore. So
they won't be able to afford them.
No. And also on an ideological level, it simply is poison at this stage. You know, I have a lot of affection, and I've said this again on many videos, I do have a lot of affection for what the BBC used to be, even though it was always lefty and it always had that spirit animating it in to various degrees. It used to be far more muted than it is now. At this stage it's just cultural Marxism wall to wall, but it did make good programs. It simply did, in every field. So I do wish, you know, I wish that it could be like that again, but you know, we've got so
much. You're wishing it could be reformed, but it seems to me it's unreformable.
Yeah, and also we've just got so many real life concerns. As I say, I think that life in Britain is going to get very, very harsh over the next, for the next 20 or 30 years, maybe much longer than that. And something like the BBC is just going to fall by the wayside. In the same way, actually, that I think the EU is going to fall by the wayside and dissolve, just going to disintegrate, because life in Europe is going to become very, very harsh.
Well, I would agree with you on that. And the thing is it's and as it does become harsh, because what's happening right now is one thing is I actually was making a video, and I haven't released it because it's extremely harsh. And what it was a comparison between human development indexes or indices and something buzzed on my computer. Human development indices and IQ. And what it was there was a reason. I mean, they just overlap. I mean, you've got a country like Japan and Singapore, which are two of the highest IQ countries in the world, and they're very developed. You've got semi-high countries like in the EU, and then you've got really, really, really low IQs, and then in Africa collectively, obviously, you've got different groups of people. People are individuals. You've got smart people, dumb people everywhere. But the thing is that what's happening right now is that people are moving from the developing world into the developed. And this one writer, what he did was he took standardized PISA scores and he compared them natives to non-natives and then to the whole. And he basically was able to look at the collective IQ of a country and whether it was moving up and down based on the movements of people. And, the United States so for example, Canada and countries like Canada, Australia, and Singapore, they have what's called they're more like elitist in their immigration policies, not insofar as family reunification, but they generally are trying to, bring in people that are not, backward goat herders, for lack of a better word. Whereas in places like the UK, Germany, and whatnot, you're just bringing in the overflow of the third world. You're bringing in people who can't even read in their own languages. And talking about bringing this back to the BBC is that, and you're saying that life is going to become harsh in places like the UK and Europe in general in the next 20 years. It's going to become harsh because what you're doing is you're importing a ready-made underclass. That's all it is. You're importing people that cannot compete and they cannot function within a society that they're moving into, and they're going to be people with their hands out for the rest of their lives. And these become basically an undertow of your society. And
yes, and I mean, the thing is, we can deal with that. Well, we can barely deal with that fact when they are a continent away, an ocean away in Africa. I think, and even then, we are riddled with guilt. We feel this terrible responsibility, and so on. What you might call the white man's burden. That's just a fact. I think we feel that responsibility. And so that's bad. It's intense enough when they are an ocean away. When they're actually in our societies. I think at present, they are never going to be on our level. It's simply not going to happen. They don't have the genes to do that. And I wish it were not the case, but I think these are simple biological realities, which are there's the documentation is there. The science is there. It's been researched. We know this to the extent that we can know it. Certainly, there's far more evidence, both on the scientific and also on the common sense level. I mean, there's far more evidence for inequality than there is for equality. There's no reason why we would be equal. It's insane. There's no reason for that.
I agree, but the argument then goes is that I completely agree with you. I mean, the documentation is out there. There's no reasonable person, and there's no reasonable person who could read all of the studies, the documentation out there, and say, "Oh yes, we're all one race. We're the human race. obviously it's rubbish. It's gibberish. I mean, we're a collection of individuals, obviously, but also we have subspecies of people. I mean, even if you look at the different groups of human beings, you look at sub-Saharan Africans, they don't contain any Neanderthal DNA, right? I mean, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know. That's not the point. But the reason, I understand the reasoning behind trying to deny reality. The reason behind trying to deny reality is that if you take away a person's, so for example, you can say, you know, this person over here is part of this group that, and this group is generally not as intelligent as this group over here. So therefore we need to, you know, mollycoddle or treat this group in, you know, this fashion. But the problem is within that same group, you might have, you know, slow people, but also brilliant people. The idea is that I understand, because what they don't want to do is pigeonhole people individually based on group characteristics. And that makes sense to me. I totally agree with that. The problem is that when you have then policy in countries that pretend groups are all the same and then import them and then say, okay, get along, you know, this is, or these people can't really do it. They can't really survive in your country, and it's your fault because they can't. So not only do you have to pay taxes, you always have to apologize for them not being capable of succeeding.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it is our fault in the sense that we are more intelligent than them. You know, in the sense that we have created our societies, sculpted them, shaped them to that standard. So, you know, we could have created shit societies and then, you know, sub-Saharan Africans would fit in just fine, but we didn't. And so it is our fault that they can't fit in that sense. So this is why, this is the root of the guilt. This is why we feel guilt. You know, at some level we know, God, you know, if we only had mud huts here, then they'd be fine. Mm-hmm. But damn, we had to build those skyscrapers. Damn, we had to build that irrigation system, that electricity system, that telephone network. And so, you know, these are the things we're proud of, and yet we know at some level these are the things they can never match. So they're going to be here, and they're constantly going to be, as you said earlier, not on our level. So I think that just cripples white people. It's this terrible, terrible sense of guilt. Which, I mean, the thing is, there's no end to it. Because they're never, you know, you can't change the situation. You could do it by genetically engineering them, in any sense. You know, you could just encourage the clever ones among them to have more kids, and you know, whatever. But that's going to take centuries. That would take centuries.
But actually, you know, the problem is that our societies aren't set up to encourage people of any group that are clever to procreate. Our societies are set up, they're dysgenic. They're set up to, you know, in the United States, I think the term is baby mama and baby daddy, or baby mama, mama. So I don't know exactly, but the idea is that, you know, you just, you know, you basically shoot out children from an assorted number of fathers, and the state will pick it up, right? And you can't have the baby daddy, I think that's the word, you can't have him living in the house, because then your benefits would be reduced. So, you know, the idea is that, you know, let's just shoot out as many kids as we can, have the state pay for us. And you've got, I've seen it in the UK too, you've got like intergenerational benefit takers. I mean, people that are...
I mean, this is not just an ethnic minority issue. Or
No, this is what I'm saying. That's what I said. I mean, it's not a racial issue, it's a dysgenic issue. It's every group of people that it's not the clever ones that are reproducing. You know, it's the ones, people that are clever, they think about making kids. They don't just, you know, go out, get a whiskey bottle and 9 months later, you know, crap out a kid. And this is where it's going, and we shall see where the road ends.
It is a scary situation, because I don't know if there is. I think the only way it's pointing is towards a much more polarized society in which there's a huge underclass and a small aristocracy. I think the middle class are just going to disappear. They're going to be, they're going to merge into, well, the working class, and then it's going to merge into the underclass. And I think we're heading towards some kind of new feudalism.
I'm not going to disagree with you at all on that whatsoever, because that, that is also part of this movement to move in massive numbers of people from the third world. You know, I was talking to some of my friends back in Vancouver, and they were telling me that, you know, okay, you know, I went to school and got an IT, you know, IT degree, but you know, they could just import people from India or China who will work for half as much. Okay. And then I got another friend, well, get a job in trades, and the exact same thing happens. So the thing is, it's not, there is no middle class anymore. The middle class is basically baby boomers living off the exhaust fumes of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, and the absolute run up of property values and stuff, and the run up of their property values, and then they're riding out the system. But anyone born from the 1970s onward, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s, and the 2000s. None of these people are going to be middle class, even if they get a PhD in mathematics and work at some sort of large tech company. It's not going to be around. It's going to either be automated or you're going to be a trash collector. I agree. The middle class is done for. And it's a setup of a large feudal system, a new neo-feudal system.
And the weird thing is, and this is something I first sort of noticed a year ago. I sort of put these two things together, and I still don't know how they fit together exactly. But the collapse of... See, the middle class used to be the ones who were prissy, hoity-toity, fastidious snobs. And they used to maintain standards in that way. It wasn't exactly nice, but it was a necessary way for... Especially in a country like Britain, and a nation like this... A group like ours, which is, I think, has a large spectrum of IQ, a large range of intelligence. So you needed a structure, a way to keep people in line, to maintain the culture. And, that was what the middle class were for culturally and socially. But, prior to that, it had been more polarized. It had been aristocracy and peasants. Fair enough. But then this middle class emerged, and for economic reasons and political reasons and so on, but culturally and socially, they fulfilled this role. Well, now what we've seen since World War One, is that increasingly that role has been corroded. We no longer believe in cultural hierarchy, or rather our societies are going in this direction where there is no cultural hierarchy anymore. So therefore, the role that the middle class used to play in upholding standards, well, that role is redundant now. If there's no hierarchy to support, then you don't need the middle class mindlessly supporting it, because there's nothing. It would be a mindless thing for them to do. They are redundant socially and culturally at this stage. I think this is, you know, you can see this in the collapse of standards of diction, standards of education, standards of thought, even. You can see it in the standards of media, drama, and so on. This is something that I used to be very concerned with. But in the first sort of year or 18 months of my channel's life, I was very concerned with this kind of thing, the new egalitarian ethos that was, well, I say new, it's been going for about 100 years. And it depressed me very much and troubled me, really disturbed me. Nowadays, I accept it nowadays. But it does fascinate me to see that as the middle class are deracinated, or let's put it this way, as they are defenestrated economically, they are also defenestrated culturally and socially. They are not needed anymore. And that fascinates me.
I'd 100% agree with you on that. I have one question. I wonder, when did the idea that when you meet people, if you ever watch any kind of movie, from even up until the 1980s, I guess, and I wasn't really cognizant at that time. I was, you know, just too young. But up until that time, when people would meet each other, they'd always use, you know, the honorifics of Mr., Mrs., you know, Mr. Smith, Mrs. Jones, yada, yada, yada. But we don't do that anymore. We interact with each other on first name basis. I noticed the Germans don't do that. anymore. Still, the Germans don't do that. They don't do that at all in Asia. Everyone is always like, you know, using the family names. But it's even now, we don't even have, you're talking about cultural hierarchy within societies and this rabid desire for everything to be egalitarian, but to the point where is if you meet a man, you know, when I was a boy, you know, you'd meet an old man or an old lady, you'd always call them, you know, Mr. Smith or Mrs. Jones. Whereas now everybody's, you know, Joe and Bob and George and Jim. Yeah. You know, even if I meet a 70-year-old person, it's not Mr. Taylor or Mr. You know, Smith. It's hey Bob, hey Joe. You know, it's it's like this is a 70-year-old man, and you're not giving any. There's a lot of the accoutrements of civilization, and of civilized discourse have been thrown to the wayside, along with all of the other things. Insofar as like you're talking about middle class, but also just the interactions between people have been reduced to a very, you know, I don't want to say it, but
I think the word is coarse.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's a good word, coarse. It's just a coarse interaction between people. You know, hey, George, you know, even though you're 75 and you're my grandfather's age, hey, you know, how you doing, George?
I mean, I've done two videos about this in the first year. What that come to mind? I probably did many more than that, but the two that come to mind are the Omni Wank of New Atheism, which went into this egalitarian, frankly nihilistic attitude, and the other one was the Virus of Informality. And I'm sure there were others as well, because it was a huge concern for me in that first year. But it's all about what we're talking about right now. It's this corrosion of the pleasantries, the niceties that used to, well, hold society together to some extent. I mean, that sounds dramatic, but I think if you'd said to the people then, what would happen if you just abolished these niceties, they probably would say, well, society would fall apart. And what's happened in the modern age is we've found much more effective, speedy ways to make society fall apart, such as importing a million people from down south. But these other things are going on at the same time. And honestly, you can say the British accent, RP, received pronunciation, is a fantastic barometer of this change. Actually, in the first year, I planned to do a major video documenting how that accent has evolved or devolved over the last 100 years. As it happened, I realized it was going to be far too much work for the sake of one video that not many people would watch, so I didn't do it. But it was going to just illustrate how the same word would be pronounced by someone who was born in 1910, and then how it was pronounced by someone who was born in 1950 and 1980, and so on. Because I guarantee each time it would become less ornate, less thoughtful, less expressive even, and it would become more dull, more brutal or brutish, and more simple. And in turn, the ways in which you can use it and become less numerous, and also the impression you give when you use it becomes more coarse. I mean, accent matters in that way. And I'm not saying that, you know, I'm a very realistic snob. I don't think that everyone should speak well. I don't want to impose that necessarily. But it is a fascinating, as I say, barometer of our cultural condition, our social condition, when we now preach that no one should speak well. And you only have to compare, for example, the royals, Prince William with Prince Charles. You know, when he was Prince William's age, it's amazing. The difference is absolutely incredible. And don't tell me that that is not the sign of a society in decline. Of course it is. It's not the sign of a society in ascent. How could it be?
I would agree with you on that. And the funny part is when you're talking about accents, I mean, as you said, you don't want to be elitist in the idea of and in North America, you've got a few different accents, and nobody. It's not like the UK with received pronunciation, or your Geordies, or your Cockney. Cockney, by the way, as I read, it's an accent going extinct. It's not going to. It's the East End of London is occupied territory. There's nobody left.
Yes, exactly. The accent is going extinct because the people are going extinct. In fact, I would say as a people, they already are extinct. This came up in an earlier one, and this came up in an earlier Hangout. I think it was last night.
Oh, yes. Really? Okay. Yeah. All I was saying is that the thing is that in North America you have the exact same thing. The only accent I think that would be that generally gets derided or ridiculed is people from the South, and their accent is I don't know, for lack of a better word, and I don't want to offend people, but I mean everybody knows it's people, you know, if you speak like a Southerner, you sound stupid, you know. And there is the tone or the focus on accents isn't so strong in North America, but I would agree with you, like within the UK, especially with something like received pronunciation, where it's something you actually have to take time at. It's not something that you just, you know, roll out of the womb and you start speaking. It is. I would agree with you. It's not a sign of a culture in a sense. It is a culture. It is a sign of a culture in descent and starting to circle the drain, for that matter. I mean, even the last time I was in London last year, and it's not a pleasant place to be. I mean the Hyde Park is nice, and going to a pub is good. The only good thing about London was alcohol is cheap. Everything else is expensive, and nothing is really that nice.
Well, I haven't been since 2008, and I would like to go. I mean, I don't know how long I'm going to stay in Britain in general, but before I go, before I leave Britain, I would like to visit London one last time and go back to my old haunts and, you know, just make some videos about it.
Because my old haunts are just, they're not even there anymore. It's just a different city.
Mm. Everyone, I haven't heard anything nice about London. Everyone says it's just a dump now. And I can believe it.
It is an absolute dump. an absolute dump. It's the only thing I have nice to say about London is the parks and the pubs. That's it. And not even the food. The food is overpriced and awful, but the only nice things I have to say about London is the parks and the pubs. Other than that, and then the pubs, as far as I understand, because I never venture into East London. Of course not. I mean, why would I do that? I mean, I don't want to lose my head. I'm being facetious, but I only ever, South London, North London, West London would be the only places that I'd never go to East London. And because from what I know, I was saying, the pubs is all the pubs are closing down in East London. There's just nothing left. They're all mosques. It's a city, it's gone. And you could also say the same thing about Paris. I was talking to my friend the other day. We traveled to Paris a couple of times. Earlier in the decade, I think the last time we were there together was 2012, and he lives here as well. And he said, it's good that we went there before it just all turned to shit. Because I mean, Paris is probably one of the most beautiful cities on the planet, and it's just a dump. It's not a dump because of the buildings, or it's a dump because of the people and the way they behave, the trash everywhere, and just feeling unease walking down the streets. Whereas, I remember going there, number of years ago, you could walk down along the Seine at nighttime and you wouldn't feel any, you could smoke a spliff or have a beer and it wouldn't make any difference. You would never fear for
This is what I want. It comes back to the thing I said earlier. Who can honestly say that Europe is better now than it was 20 years ago? I just don't understand how people. I mean, I know, you've got the fucking restaurants, but life in general and the atmosphere in general is menacing. I was in Rotterdam, and it's just this horrible sense of, at best, ambivalence, and at worst, latent malevolence towards you as a white guy, white person.
No, I was in Rotterdam only one time, and it was about 15 years ago, and it was already not a very good city to be in, to tell you the truth.
Well, it wasn't very nice in September 2016. I can tell you that.
Yeah, I watched your video on your speech there. It was really good. It was good, but it was a dump 15 years ago too. So I imagine it's just become an even larger dump.
Well, I was in Paris in 2002, and I only know I know that because I saw Kraftwerk playing there, and the Cité de la Musique in Paris. And I wish I could remember what it was like. I remember seeing a lot of sort of Arabs and that kind of thing, but not to the extent that people say now that, you know, Paris is just lost. You know,
it's gone. Yeah, it's gone. It is lost.
Yeah, people are quoting Kraftwerk lyrics in the chat now. Please keep that coming, because I do smile every time. She's a model. Yeah, I know.
Who? I'm not sure.
Kraftwerk. They're a German. They are a German group, and they play around Europe and America now. They haven't released anything new for a long, long time, but they keep playing live, so it's good. Okay. So, yeah, well, Paris, I don't know why. I can't see myself going back there. That's the thing, you know, it's at the stage now. Why would I go to, I don't know, Frankfurt? Why would I go to Rome? Why would I go to Zurich? I don't care anymore. Why would I go to Vienna? What's the point? You know, these places have entirely... or almost entirely lost their identities, lost what they were just 20 years ago. The change has been really astronomical. The same with Edinburgh and Glasgow, in fact. It's transformed, especially in the last... I mean, it accelerates, but I'd say the last 5 years have been just amazing. And I don't know what critical... point it's got. I don't know how bad it has to get before people suddenly realize, holy shit, it's not like it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago, and things are actually getting worse.
I wonder about that, and you know, the one thing is that I have to say I don't see a tipping point anymore. I just see people accepting it, and the reason this is why I'm going to say it, and I know I'm going to get a lot of shit for saying it, but if a country can allow thousands of their young daughters to be groomed, pimped, and raped by people from Pakistan or people from Afghanistan or wherever they were, and there isn't a revolt against local police, against local governments, against national governments, if you can have a man in uniform. So what I've read is in the UK is they now don't really want their servicemen to be wearing their uniforms in public anymore for fear of Islamic attacks in their capital city, in London. So you had a Lee Rigby, a young soldier, be decapitated in Woolwich, just South London. He had his head pretty much cut off for wearing the uniform of the nation state that he's in. He's representing the nation in the capital city, and he was beheaded. And you have thousands of young girls all across. They focus on Rotherham, but I mean it's up and down the country, and you have actively police, government, and media trying to not only sequester this information but out and out lie about it. But even when it does come up, you have groups like the English Defence League, the EDL, who come up and say, okay, we don't like this, we're going to... But the problem is what they do is they get drunk and they cause, you know, little bits of ruckus here and there. And then you have the middle class looking down their noses at them and sneering, going, look at the plebs acting up, you know. Mm-hmm. And if thousands of girls being raped and service members in uniform being beheaded in your capital city, happening, and there is no large-scale revolts, I don't know what would. And especially the defilement of your young women, of your young girls.
Yeah,
the defilement of your young girls not causing an absolute utter cacophony of anger and resentment and just rage. I don't know what would. I mean, you could talk about, you know, blowing up churches. You could talk about, you know, X, Y, and Z, but the defilement of your young girls not causing a national crisis, I don't know what will.
I know. Well, I mean, it's the same in Germany with Cologne. I thought And I think in the first Cologne video I talked about this, I contrasted Rotherham, which is what you're referring to, the 1,400 girls. I contrasted that with Cologne. It was a sort of interesting thing to speculate on, but ultimately it's still the same thing. Young women were defiled. And no, in the case of Cologne, it was, as far as we know, it wasn't rape. I think there was a few.
I think there was like two or three gang rapes, and there was maybe another rape. But yeah, mostly it was sexual assault. But yeah, there was a couple of gang rapes, as I've read. Yeah, but it wasn't like out of the number. It was a low number.
Yeah, it's difficult to keep up with that because I remember one woman claimed to have been raped, and then she admitted that she'd made it up because she was some kind of activist, some women's rights activist. I mean, it's really fucking annoying to have that distortion. But I don't know if there were any real rapes as such, but let's just assume there weren't. Let's just assume it was all sexual assault. You're still talking about hundreds of women being molested, assaulted by hundreds of men who had only been in the country a matter of months or weeks. And that is, you know... Of course, it was Merkel's decision in September. Like, what was that? 4 months before the Cologne incident, which anyone could have, as you said at the very start, anyone could have predicted that. And I think, see, this is what gets me. When I saw the footage of those rivers of young men, black men, Arabs, and so on, coming through German villages, I just thought, holy fuck. I mean, how can any man look at that and not think this is a serious, serious situation? How can any man, how castrated would you have to be to look at that and think, oh, well, good, ambivalent, marvelous, whatever. Anything less than, anything other than outrage, shock, worry and fear is a terrible sign of the state of Europe's men.
Oh, no, I agree, because just at a primordial level, as you said, watching these long lines or these just endless to the horizon of these men marching through these small towns, you know, coming up from you know, Austria and then into Germany and, you know, previously in the Balkans, and not having a sense of foreboding, you basically have... If you don't have any sense of urgency whilst watching that as a man, you're not a man. Because I mean, as a species, as an animal, we are territorial. I mean, all animals are. But it's also the thought of this large this invasion force, for lack of a better word, marching into your country, and it's all young men coming from very sexually repressed societies. So if you had, you know, a million people marching in from Argentina, you wouldn't be as worried, you know, for the safety of your women. I mean, the reason being is because, I mean, you know, you have some sort of cultural commonality with these people. But like just watching that is just watching men in these groups going, refugees welcome, hey ho, we're refugees. I can't remember what the chant was. Refugees welcome here, 1, 2, 3, 4. And I mean, just the I don't like using the word cuck because I think it's overused. But I don't have a better adjective for these men. I just don't. Because there is at a biological level, these men are negating their own existence, pretty much.
Yeah, they are. When you know, it comes down to that, these men are going to replace you by mating with your women, and it's as clear cut and primal as that. Of course, when you're talking about emasculation, there, another video in my Cologne series was about a sort of adjunct to the Cologne story, which is that in Amsterdam, later in the January this year, a bunch of guys did a protest. I mean, it was 300 men, 300 young men, young Dutch men. They did a protest where they wore miniskirts. And the idea was that they were saying women should be allowed to dress any way they like, and men shouldn't sexually molest them because they're dressed scantily. So it was, I mean, Yeah, the layers of dishonesty, delusion, and cowardice in that are really something to behold. Because, I mean, it was only happening because someone must have said, I'm guessing someone must have said post-Cologne, well, the women were dressed scantily. So they kind of brought this and they invited this. And so these young guys thought, oh, well, here's a clever idea. We'll do this thing to protest that statement. But they're not protesting the actual reality. You know, they're entirely avoiding the reality.
And what do you think the Arabs and the Muslims and the Africans marching into Europe and actually perpetrating these acts and then viewing the response, what do you think they're thinking? Okay, well, we've marched into their country. We're living off of their welfare systems. We're molesting and raping their women. And their response is, well, their men are putting on dresses and marching in the streets.
Yeah,
how are they viewing this?
I mean, what are they thinking when they see European men doing that? And what European men from history, what would they have done 100 years ago? It's inconceivable.
This wouldn't have happened 100 years ago. It would be inconceivable for it to even have begun. So yeah, no, I mean, it's just out of control.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And if it had happened somehow, the reaction would have been very different and far more, far less cowardly. I mean, that Dutch. My video was called The Dutch Miniskirt Debacle. And that debacle is just such a terrible illustration of the state of modern European men. Because I'm guessing that these guys, I don't know if they were all liberal humanities students. I'd like to think that they were, but I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of them were STEM. This is the sort of level of political engagement that even, you know, supposedly hard-headed Europeans have nowadays. They'll see something like Cologne and think, right, okay, how can I avoid looking at this seriously? How can I avoid the obvious ramifications of this? How can I make a joke out of this? How can I virtue signal about even this thing? And they find a way to do it. You know, this is, I suppose, that you could say that's the inventiveness of the European mind, that something like Cologne happens, and even then they find a way to look the other way and put on a fucking miniskirt. I mean,
in a very, very unique way.
Yeah, it's loathsome. It's really loathsome. I think, I suppose we should be trying to heading towards wrapping up. But the European situation is very scary. And I think that, I mean, some people think protesting is the answer. I think that plays a role, but I think even that is not enough. It has to be underpinned by a wider cultural change. And this is what
I don't advocate anything, but I think that train has left the station. Protest isn't going to change anything at this point.
Yeah.
That train is long gone. You know, we're standing on the platform and it's not coming back.
Yeah. And one of the things I said in the Cologne and the German Elite video, Pegida did a protest, and the cathedral, the Cologne Cathedral, switched its lights off in protest at Pegida protest.
I think I read something about that. Yeah.
That was last January. So even almost 2 years ago. So even if you do a protest, the social institutions in Cologne, in Germany, will then work against you for doing the protest. You know, we're at this stage where the systems of our societies are actively working against us. There's a medical term for this, with eating yourself. I think it's autophagy or something like that. And I think that's very much what we're seeing here. So to get back to what I was saying, I think that a cultural change has to happen, a psychological change has to happen, and a spiritual change has to happen. And until that does happen, we're just pissing about. I mean, it's protests aren't going to achieve that. And for what it's worth, violence also isn't going to achieve what's necessary. There has to be a deep spiritual change here. And maybe in order to bring that about, we have to suffer even more. But it just seems amazing to me. To me, it's just so blatantly obvious. I can't believe that anyone else can't see it. But they can't, because they don't want to.
Like you said, people don't want to see it. And the reason they don't want to see it is because that brings them to a very dark place. you know, people are much happier living. I mean, people like to use these terms like red pills, blue pills, black pills. You know, I don't like using those either. But the thing is to actually confront the reality is a very, very dark place to go. And the options are equally as dark, you know, and the solutions are equally as dark. And the idea that this is just going to, if you can just keep treading water, you're not treading water, you're treading pudding, you know, at a point you're going to run out of steam and you're just going to sink. And pretty much people are doing that right now. They're treading pudding.
Yeah.
And they're hoping, you know, I can just stay, keep my head above the pudding a little bit longer, above the butter, whatever, some sort of thick, solid substance or, you know, not solid, but I mean, this is where we're at right now. And people, the reason they don't want to is because it'll take them to a very dark place.
Exactly. They know what they would have to look at if they looked at it. So, and also it would not just be an external thing. It would be their own fucking weakness. And, you know, people hate admitting that they've been wrong. This is why you've got second wave feminists now who still refuse to accept that, you know, millions of depressed young women is the result of their policies. They will never admit that because it would mean admitting that they've been wrong for 50 years. And I think in a more general sense, what you're saying is correct. You know, people don't want to admit, especially if, imagine being one of those guys, those Dutch guys who'd worn a fucking miniskirt. Would you want to admit, God, that was really stupid what I did? Now, my women, and they are my women, Dutch women, must have seen me doing that, and they must have thought, I can't rely on him. I can't trust him. And so I've made a complete arse of myself. Well, that would be a really humiliating thing for a young guy to realize. So it's easier for him, on his conscience, just to continue the delusion, even if it's really... Well, even if it's quite arduous to do that, it's kind of more comfortable just to continue, because as we've said, admitting the truth is horrifying. But this is why we have to band together and help each other to admit the truth, to acknowledge it. No one is in this on their own, and I think
no, absolutely, no man is an island.
No, and I think this is what the alt-right is all about. Ultimately, we have to help each other to wake up and face this. What did you say?
No, I just said 100% agree with you.
Mm-hmm. I know that you're not, I mean, do you consider yourself alt-right?
No, I don't. I don't like to classify myself. I would probably have certain ideas that would be sympathetic, but not everything. So I think, I don't like to, you know, for example, you one of the ones, oh, I'm a radical egalitarian. I think that the term du jour these days is I'm a classical liberal egalitarian. You know, fuck that. People have lots of different identities. I like watching Star Trek, you know, like science fiction movies. I would agree with a lot of it, but not everything, you know.
It's understandable.
Yeah, and I also don't like to pigeon myself.
Good, very good, very droll.
But I don't mean, no pun intended. But I think, I would definitely. I'm an ally. I'm not an enemy. That's for sure. I just don't like to classify myself as one thing or another. To tell you the truth, that's probably all. Mostly the reason. And I also think that, you know, I'm also always open to changing my mind if somebody has a better argument, right? So maybe I will be one day, you know, who knows? I'm not clever enough to believe that everything I believe now is what I'm going to believe forever. I mean, you get people that are so locked into their positions and so, you know, covetous to their own point of view that they are inflexible and incapable of changing their mind. And I think that's the death of people, to tell you the truth. And it's the death of intellectualism as well. And I'm not calling myself an intellectual by any stretch of the word. I'm just saying that I'm always open to new ideas and things. But I mean, I think with the alt-right, I think that there's a lot of good ideas. I think there's some ideas that are impractical and won't work, but, I would definitely call myself an ally. I mean, obviously you and I chat all quite often. So, definitely.
Yeah, indeed.
Definitely an ally, not an enemy for any stretch of the word.
Okay. Shall we move on to some questions from the viewers?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Okay. I'll just link to the video where you can post questions. I can't keep up with the chat. I'm sorry. So I need you to post questions in under this video, which I'm pasting into the thing now.
Chat's moving pretty quick. While you're doing that, can you give me 1 minute? I have to actually do something for less than 30 seconds.
That's fine. I'll go and get a drink.
All right, perfect.
Okay. In the meantime, people can post questions under that video. I'll post that again.
I'd like to answer some questions because I don't really ever do this with even my own channel. So if anybody would like to ask some questions of us, okay. I'd definitely like to answer some.
Okay. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Me too. I'm also going to get a drink as well.
Okay.
All right. I'm back, if you are. All right. Here. Hello, NC Wright. Hello, Godzilla 37. La Cringe. Shit and Piss Stop.
Okay.
Okay. Hello, Mr. Woes.
Hello. Right. Okay. He needs Kraftwerk playing during this. All right. Okay, so I'll get the questions from earlier, and we can start with those.
Pete Grabler, hello. I'm just answering a couple of people in the chat. They're just saying hello.
Pete Gabler's been on my channel since the
Jackson.
Start.
Hello. Hello, Mr. Teacup. Hello, George Soros. Jez. Esoteric pigeonism. That's the... That comes from the poor guy Alexander Johannes, I think. Did you ever get him on your channel?
No, I invited him, but I stipulated that he would have to be open minded, and he refused. So I thought, right, okay, I'm not having you on then.
Because I tried to talk to him a little bit, with one of my pigeons is biting my toes, just. And I don't wear socks and she likes to bite humans like
this is behind the scenes of Black Pigeon Speaks.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm just ouch. He's cuckooing angry because I am not going to give him my. But
what does he think about the migrant crisis?
We don't want him there. Get out. Is that right? This one is black. So he refused to come on your channel, Alexander Johannes.
Yeah.
He's
I probably have more luck with one of your pigeons, to be honest.
Probably
be more open-minded.
I don't know. He's so ideologically boxed in. I tried to talk to the lad too, and he made a video talking about, I hate the alt-right and the pigeons and black pigeons. And, what is it? His thing. It was greetings from the grand spectrum of time in the multiverse. Yeah. My name is Black Pigeon Speaks. Anyway,
the guy was troubled, and I felt sorry. And I thought, if you're going to come on, then the only productive way to do it is for you to ask me questions about the alt-right, but you'll have to be open-minded. So he refused to do that. So I thought, well, okay, well, there's no point then, because I'm not going to have him on and just make, you know, talk down to him or.
No, of course not. Yeah. He doesn't do that. No, absolutely.
No, I didn't think it would be ethical to do that.
No,
so,
absolutely not.
But he refused to do the only ethical, to facilitate me in the only ethical way. So that was it. That was that. I wanted to help him, to be honest. I wanted to help him understand.
I was the same way. I actually made him when I kind of ran into him quite early, and I made him a new intro for his show because he is the black.
I wondered about that.
Yeah, I made him an intro, but he only used it. He used it once maybe, and then like, oh, but it comes from Black Pigeon and he's alt-right and I'm against the alt-right. And then he made some video against me, and then I tried to be nice. And I just wanted to help the guy, but he just was very obstinate.
Mm. You know,
There was nothing really you could do. I mean, poor him.
No. Well, yeah, exactly. I tried to help him, but that was that. Okay, let's move on to the questions.
Sure.
The first one is, what are your thoughts on Alberta? My impression is that the people who live there are the least pretentious and the least brainwashed in Canada. Mm-hmm. Is Alberta separatism a complete pipe dream? Or could it happen?
It's a pipe dream. First and foremost, Alberta being the oil production center of Canada before oil tanked. Invited, but a lot of parts of Canada are fairly poor, especially the Maritime provinces, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, and a lot of people from very liberal parts of the country moved into Alberta to work within. I mean, not everyone's working on in the oil industry, but they are working in ancillary industries that support it. And when oil tanked, what did they do? They had a provincial election and they voted for the New Democratic Party. And the New Democratic Party in Canada would be Labour on steroids. They're communists. They got into power in my home province, British Columbia, a number of years ago, and they destroyed the province economically. They are the real Albertans are. They're more like people you'd meet in the Midwest in the United States, like Montana, the Dakotas, Nebraska, that kind of place. And I would agree. They're the least pretentious, but they're not the least. I mean, the Maritime people, they're not so bad either. The pretentious people in Canada are all from the large cities, but Alberta becoming independent is never going to happen. If Quebec being French Canadian hasn't become independent at this point, no, it's a pipe dream.
Okay, all right. Here's another question: have you heard of the Kalergi plan?
Oh yes, I have, absolutely. And I don't. I mean, I know that he is the ideological father of the EU. I know that he talked about wanting to merge, and these are his words. A Eurasian with the Negroid, and these are his words, not mine, to create a new man. And the idea that this is a large topic on a lot of sites and a lot of a lot of groups. But the thing is that I don't know how much this supposed plan has any actuality in reality, if it's an actual real thing. So, but the blueprint is being carried out, you know, right on plan, right on schedule. But whether it's an actual detailed plan that's going on in Bohemian Grove, I don't know. I really don't know.
Okay. All right, the next one. Okay. Recently, you produced a video explaining why porn is cancer. How do you reconcile this with the fact that a great deal of alt-right propaganda consists of appeals to sexual insecurity, i.e. calling political opponents cuckolds? Every second discussion in alt-right circles arrives at different ethnicities mating with each other, etc. I would consider this conduct and vocabulary pretty obscene and therefore, in a sense, also pornographic. In light of this, do you not think that the alt-right would have a harder time in a society that was more restrictive of porn and obscenity?
Well, to start with, I'm not about restricting pornography. I'm not about restricting anything anybody reads, sees, hears, or even any kind of restrictions on information whatsoever. I don't believe in that. What the video was about was more pornography is... People try and say that we are the ones that are creating pornography, and our society is you know, the one in, we are reflecting pornography now at this point. I mean, when I grew up, you know, there was, you know, soft porn, there was magazines, there was, you know, photos on the internet, but you know, the level of pornography, the amount of pornography is absolutely out of control. I mean, you just have to get on your computer and in 3 minutes you can be watching some woman get slapped up and fucked by 20 midgets as she's farting out milk, and everyone's jacking off to this every single day. And what it does is it creates not only problems for people psychologically in their own life, in their own sex life, and their ability to meet women, but it also, I don't think it's good for you spiritually. I think I'm not against porn. Like, I'm saying that the porn that we have today, and the amount of porn and the kinds of porn we have today, are cancer. I mean, you know, I don't ever really watch reaction videos to the videos I make. I just find that people, if all they can ever do is make a reaction video to somebody else's ideas, then you basically have no ideas of your own. I mean, let's just be honest. You have entire channels built around, oh, let's talk about this SJW and the mainstream meteor and what did this SJW say, and let's make fun of that. I mean, people that are making reaction videos about something, for example, like the porn video, or they're talking about, you know, X, Y, and Z, it's not the reality of what somebody is saying. They're manipulating their own ideas into it. But getting back to that about cuckold and porn, the reason I guess I would say the alt-right is talking about things like cuckolds and like you're saying, it's sexual insecurity. It's not sexual insecurity, and it's basically a sexual fetish, and it's a fetish that's created by men that are, let's put it bluntly, they're not masculine. Right, and that's what it is. They're making fun of it. It's like the cuckservative. It's getting back to the state of European men that we were talking about before. Men that enjoy watching their own woman being defiled by another man and getting off on it are not men. They're not, and they lack all of the impulses and instincts that men have had since time immemorial. And so, vocabulary being used to shame men, like the word cuck, is a very different thing than socially cancerous, violent, overindulgent, over-amplified, over-volumed pornography that we're witnessing today in our society. So I'm not against pornography. I think it's a spiritually damaging force in our society, and it's not something humanity has ever had on tap, and in the quantities and in the sheer volume of disgustingness that we have today. So I don't know if that answers it. It kind of It's kind of a long-winded answer, but
okay. All right, here's another one. Women, when compared to men, do not care that much about cultural inheritance and nationalism, not to mention race. How do you plan to change that, knowing that women are overrepresented in the lower education system?
Cut off welfare. Welfare states, and government help and subsidies of people's lifestyles is what's creating this. To change this, all you need to do is cut off the money. Women are able to make bad choices based on the fact that they're not going to be held responsible for those choices. The taxpayer is going to pick up for their poor decisions in life. So, for example, you know, if you look back at our grandparents' time, you know, women would be very selective with the men that they would copulate with. And the reason they would do that is because there would be very serious consequences if they chose the wrong man and a man that wasn't responsible for her or the outcome of his actions. And her life would be potentially completely ruined. But the thing is now, and we talked about this before with the baby mamas and the baby daddies, people's lives are basically kept on life support, even though they choose to create some of the most stupid, they choose some of the most stupid outcomes for their life because they just don't think. Young women are not, they're not frightened by the world because there is no consequences for the actions that they do. And it's because they live in a society that will always pick up the slack for their stupidity. So if you wanted to ask, the way to change that is just to shut off the money, to shut off the welfare.
Okay. I would also suggest closing humanities departments wherever possible.
Well, I would agree with you. I'd 100% agree with you. But I mean, that would be a bit totalitarian, trying to stop ideas. You can stop money. But trying to stop ideas is not something I think anyone should ever do, even if they're bad ideas, because it's the marketplace of ideas. And that's what the other side does. The one thing that I always notice is there's a petition going on. Somebody sent it to me. There's some sort of petition by some feminist to try to get Google to shut down my channel because I hurt their feelings about, you know, look at the titles of his videos. Only men pay taxes, or, you know, how women objectify themselves, yada, yada, yada. And, you know, they're trying to shut me down. And this is what always happens is the left is always trying to shut down people's voices and people's ideas. Right. And I don't ever want to do that. You know, I don't ever want to shut down, even if I disagree with it, or even if I think it's a bad idea.
Right. Okay. That's the other one. Oh, yeah. I have noticed that vegetarianism is gaining popularity on the right wing. Do you believe that as the left wing becomes more pro-establishment and mainstream, traditionally leftist causes will be adopted and become synonymous with the right wing? Would it be productive to infiltrate environmental groups or just to make our own new ones?
I don't think infiltrating an organization is worth it, and I think ideas that you have should come because you actually agree with them, not because they're politically expedient at the moment. I'm a vegetarian, and I've been for years, and the reason I am is I'm an ethical vegetarian. I have a problem with if I see people, you know, like they're enjoying their meat, I don't care. But, you know, when I see a turkey, it disturbs me. And it just disturbs me also for the way that the animal has been treated. And it has nothing to do with my politics with regards to, for example, migrant crises. And I would consider myself right of center on a lot of things. But also I'm left of center on things like healthcare. For example, I believe in things like, for example, the NHS in the UK. I don't think that being sick should become and whether you live or die should be dependent on whether you have enough insurance like they have in the United States. So I have a very left of center position on healthcare. But with regards to vegetarianism, I would be considered, yeah, traditional leftist things. The thing is that to be a well-rounded person, you can't only subscribe to what would be your political ideology and the general positions of it. So I don't think infiltration is an idea, and I don't think starting up your own organizations is an idea. I think you should choose your positions based on what your conscience and what your mind and your experience tell you. So it's more of a matter of living your conscience rather than trying to play things that are politically expedient, if that matters.
Okay. Here's someone saying, please conduct the street interviews that you mused over concerning Far Eastern ethno-consciousness.
Mm. Oh, yeah, I'm going to do that. The thing is the reason I even said that is because I know what's going to happen. It's basically going to be pretty much, yes, we don't want to change our culture. Yes, we're very happy. No, we would never want to be like London. I know exactly what the answers are going to be, and that's kind of why I wanted to do it. It's I've got actually a few people here now. It's funny because when I actually came out that I lived in Tokyo on my channel, I've gotten a dozen people that live here that watch my thing. Like, yeah, I want to help. So yeah, that's in the works right now as we speak. Probably by January. In January.
All right.
Because I'm going to need somebody with a microphone, somebody with a camera, you know, and then somebody with a, you know, maybe like a 3-man team or something. So, and a lot of my friends that I have right now don't want to help me.
All right. I want to ask. Okay. Often in your videos, you appear to conflate the ideas of racial and cultural homogeneity. Mm-hmm. To what extent do you believe in ethno-nationalism, that being the total or near-total presence of a single race or ethnic group in one country?
Sorry, again, I conflate cultural homogeneity with racial homogeneity?
Yeah, that's what this person's saying.
They're saying that I'm mixing the two up, or I'm not mixing the two up. I'm conflating, so I'm mixing the two. Okay, well, what I'll say is that I think I'm not a hardline ethno-nationalist. I think that some immigration is fine. I don't mind having different kinds of people at all. I would say I'm more of a cultural nationalist, but I would stipulate that there has to be a majority group. Absolutely. There has to be a majority group in which to amend yourself to, or to join. I think that, when I was growing up, the city I was in was, 80-90% European and 10% other, and that was fine. And you could even bring it down to into the 70s, I would say, so long as people shared the same culture. I don't see it as a problem. The problem is that what's happening now is you have blocks of people moving in, and there's no need or reason to assimilate. So I'm not an ethno-nationalist, and that's probably one of the things that I diverge from with the alt-right. But I am a cultural nationalist, I guess, that people need to subscribe to the dominant group within a society. And for example, if that society was, say, for example, Scotland, I think that the vast, vast majority of people should be Scots. And I don't think that I should apologize for that, because, I mean, Scotland is called Scotland because it's made up of Scots, right? And I'm not a hardline ethno-nationalist at all. I have friends who are East Indians, or I guess you'd call them Asians in the UK. East Indians is what they're called in North America, because there's dot Indian and feather Indian, so they're just called East Indians. I've got East Indian friends. I've got Oriental friends. I've got friends of all colors, and I'm not a hardline racialist in the sense that I only want to be friends with or have certain people in my life that are only one kind. So, but I recognize the value of having a dominant group within a society. And I especially since I live in an Asian country, because I mean, I see it here. I mean, I'm living in an ethno state. It's 99.9% of them. And I see it works a hell of a lot better than multiculturalism. it works a lot better than multiculturalism.
Okay, yeah, I can just remember what it was like. Okay, here's a question. And there are many questions coming in, so I'll try to be...
I'll try to be quicker with each one. Sorry, I'm just...
Okay, we'll see how we go.
Long-winded, yeah.
All right. Do you plan on debating anyone from the skeptic community, since they have recently been attacking the alt-right with non-arguments and calling us Nazis, etc.?
Well, I haven't had any invitations to debate. I mean, to be honest, I did V, and actually, funnily enough, him and I have actually become kind of friends. We chat online all the time. I think V in that position, I think he was being argumentative to be argumentative, because in the end, I think he agrees with pretty much everything I was saying, and I think he was just being argumentative for the point. Since then, I haven't gotten any. I mean, the skeptic community, as I said to you before, I mean, they're called skeptics because they've got no ideas of their own. So we're just skeptical of other people's ideas, but we have no ideas of our own. So it's kind of hard to debate with people that don't really have any of their own ideas. All they're doing is arguing your ideas. Do you know what I mean? They're not offering anything. They don't bring anything to the table.
They're just being acid, really.
Exactly. So I don't have any, but I mean, if the chance arises, sure, why not?
Okay. And that person also congratulates you on triggering the new atheists, by the way.
Oh, okay. Well, so say thank you for that one, because I mean, that video was kind of just in a response. I tried to be as respectful as I could of both sides, and I'm not religious, but yeah, I just find that I lost, I think I told you before the chat began, I lost, I don't know, 400 or 500 subscribers the day that video came out, because it's like, I don't agree with you, fuck you, Black Pigeon, I am unsubbing, and the funny part is they always tell you, fuck you, I'm unsubscribing, like, it's like, oh, sorry, you know, like, but they always have to tell you, I'm not subscribing to you anymore. Fuck you, and I'm not subscribing. And it's like, well, it's just an opinion. Like in the words of Jeffrey Lebowski, it's just an opinion, man. You know. So.
Okay.
Tell him I said thank you, or okay. Thank you.
Yeah. He has a very long name, so I won't read it out to you. But just Muhammad, he says thank you. Okay. And he also asks, what's your ethnicity?
My ethnicity is British, some German, and that's it, basically. A little bit of French-Canadian, as far as I know.
Okay. So, yeah. Okay. Someone's saying, ask BPS about Sweden and LSD. I don't know what that's referring to.
Sweden, well, I don't know. Sweden, the best man at my wedding, he's Swedish. He's been a friend of mine for a long, long time. So I have spent some time there. Sweden's done. I think Sweden's the canary in the coal mine. They're going to be the first country in Europe that'll fall. They're done. They're not recoverable. They're finished. They're going to turn into a Sharia laden shithole within probably the next 20 years. And you're going to see a lot of these people with the, we love refugees, hitting the back door and trying to get out. LSD. I made a video on that a long time ago. I dabbled in it as a youth. It brings very profound changes to the way you see reality. I'm not advertising it or telling anyone to do it, but it is not as bad as the advertisements would have you believe. It's a very transformative experience if you're willing to do it, but you have to go into it with a clear mind and emotionally sound basis. Because if you're not emotionally, if you're carrying a lot of emotional baggage or you're not emotionally stable, it can be extremely, extremely bad thing to do.
Mm. Okay. Here's a good one. Kirk or Picard?
Ooh, hard one. I like Kirk for his dalliances with the Green Ladies, just he's a very amorous man.
Virile is the word.
Virile, that's right. So I told you last night I tied one on, and it's just sort of waking up this morning. morning, still shaking off the previous night. I like Picard for his reflection. One of my favorite episodes was when I don't know if you're a Star Trek watcher or a fan of it, but
I have watched all of TNG, but it was about five years ago now.
Okay, so you know there's an episode where Q, who's a reoccurring character in the Next Generation, he comes back and he transforms Picard from his current self back into his younger body, and part of the transformation was as he brings him back to a point in his life where he was stabbed by a Narsican, and that's why he had a fake heart. And the thing was is he put him back where he was this very introspective, very reflective man into his young self, and it completely changed the course of his entire life. Whereas when he was a young man, he was impulsive and he was out there, he was aggressive and whatnot. And I liked the character arc of Picard. You know, he seemed to have a much deeper fleshed out character than Kirk. But I liked Kirk for his bravado and his womanizing ways. So it's a tie. I didn't like Janeway at all. I thought she was just I didn't mind Sisko, Captain Sisko. He was okay. So I'm going to go Kirk and Picard.
What about Scott Bakula's character in Enterprise?
Oh, this is one thing, man. Enterprise gets so crapped on by fans, but I actually just picked up Enterprise. I never watched it up until I think about a year ago, and I just watched the whole series in one go. And I loved it. I thought Enterprise was probably the best Star Trek there was. The stories and just the, it wasn't just everyone getting along and Deanna Troi having, you know, her period and searing, you know, feeling everybody's emotions. I thought it was a really good show. And I thought T'Pol, I always thought the Seven of Nine on Voyager was the hottest, but man, that T'Pol, she's got to be the hottest Vulcan on, you know, this
side. Seven of Nine is incredible.
Oh, she was hot as hell. I'm not going to deny that. She was the hottest. But when once I saw that T'Pol, yeah, man, she was hot too. Really hot. I liked the T'Pol.
Okay. What was the next one? I was going to... Hold on a minute. Oh, yeah. Your hopes and reservations for the Trump administration.
My hopes are he'll follow through with some of the things he says. I'd like to see, for example, America pulling back from a lot of the... entanglements and a lot of its obligations to countries that don't reciprocate. I think he was talking about renegotiating NATO. I think that's long overdue. I think Europeans have been riding the coattails of American security for generations now. And what they've done is they've come to this complacent attitude that they don't have to even give any notice to their own security, and then at the same time belittle the United States at every juncture. I mean, whenever I go to Europe, everybody thinks I'm American. Well, I am. I have a passport. I have a U.S. passport, but I have never really lived very much time there. But, you know, I always get, you know, when I'm in Paris, I get, you know, shat on by waiters because they think, oh, he's the American. Fuck you, fucking American. So I really would like to see Trump renegotiate relationships that the United States has that have been abused, I think, for generations. I think I'd like to see him. I read something recently where he's talking about canceling the new F-35 fighter because of cost overruns. And then there was just a couple days later, the CEO was saying, we're going to try to bring costs down. I'd like to see him build the wall with Mexico and deport all of these people that shouldn't be in the country. They just shouldn't be there. Reservations I have, I think he's an egomaniac, and he has too much bravado. The fact that he's still posting on Twitter the way he was prior to the election or when he was a TV host kind of worries me a little bit. The fact that I've read that he doesn't read any books worries me. You know, he gets all of his information from television. I think he has the potential to be a very good president, but he needs to have handlers that will steer him in the right direction. You know, so I worry about his, not his inexperience so much, but his lack of interest, it would seem, in things. I mean, he's a businessman, but running a country is not the same as running a business. It is in certain senses, but my reservations are quite large. But in the end, he's much, much better than the alternative.
Certainly, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. What was the... Oh, yeah. Do you think we can do a biological and cultural time capsule for Europeans? A biological time capsule for Europeans?
Biological time capsule. I guess you could. I mean, it would just be taking like DNA. I mean, something like they have, I think it's in Norway, they have the seed bank. Is it Norway or Iceland or somewhere up the north? I guess you could add it, maybe. I mean, a time capsule. The thing is in the future, will anybody really care? You know, I mean, will we be just like Neanderthals, a footnote in history? I mean, it's starting to look like that. And the funny part is that they're also trying to erase our history and our identity. You made a video on that yourself about, I think it was European people's art, and on when you did a Google search, and there was recently there was a one of these first person shooter games I saw. I can't remember whether it was Call of Duty or one of these. I stopped playing video games a number of years ago, because not that I don't like playing them, but I just you just waste so much time on them. They're time sinks, right? And they're addictive. So I kind of turned them on. I mean, if I got a PlayStation 4, I'd be playing it 24/7. So I don't. But there was recently one of these first person shooter games centered around World War I, and the main player was a black man. This was a war that decimated an entire generation of Europeans, millions and millions and millions of them. And the media and the games coming out now portray it as though it was a war fought in Europe by black people.
Which war was that?
World War I. It's a video game. Okay. It's Call of Duty, or it's one of these really popular first person action shooters. So first person shooter games, and it's one of the really the ones that, you know, they make 10 or 15 of them. You know, it's and it's this one centered on the First World War, trench warfare, and it's the Allies versus the Germans, I guess, you know, and the main character and the squad is blacks. They're blacks. So they're portraying the First World War fought in Europe as being fought by black people. And this is one of these really large games that have come out. It's like one of these, I don't follow video games so much anymore, like EA or Electronic Arts, or one of these really large companies. It's one of these franchise games that you get all of these fanboys playing millions. Maybe somebody in the chat can help me with this, because I'm sure somebody knows what I'm talking about. And
Battlefield 1, apparently.
Okay, that's okay. And, okay, and that's
apparently someone says it was made by Swedes.
Fucking hell. Well, there you go. There you go. I mean, does it surprise you? Does it fucking surprise you? Here we go. Yeah, Battlefield 1. Okay, yeah. So we was blitzing. We was Kangs. Yeah, so we was Kangs of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. Exactly. So we was the Kangs of the Austrian. And it's just, it's erasure is what's happening of a history.
Yeah. I mean, there are other examples that I've seen, and I think I've talked about on the channel, but I won't go into them now. Okay, what are your thoughts on Bolshevism and the Bolshevik Revolution?
I think the Bolsheviks, I mean, that's getting into a lot of different territory, too. It's getting into, like, Trotskyism, the Jewish question, a lot of those sort of things. I would say the Bolshevik Revolution hasn't ended, really. It hasn't ended. It's just mutated and morphed. If what you see going on right now in places like the UK and the United States, in the entire Western world, the Marxism and the cultural Marxism is an offshoot of 1917. It's 1917 carried forward 100 years and mutated and changed, but it's essentially the same thing. It's basically a mental virus trying to inculcate entire civilizations into ideologies that are basically incompatible with humanity.
Okay. That's a very good summary. All right. Can Trump be pushed further to the right now that he is elected, or will the pressure be totally the other way?
No, I think his first term, he'll have to remain moderate if he can get a second term. This is the thing about Trump that's different from every other politician that's ever been in. To be honest, if he doesn't make it through his first term without getting JFK'd, I'll be surprised, because he's hitting a lot of piñatas. In he's hitting the military industrial complex. He's hitting the banks. He's hitting all of the different security services. He's rustling a lot of jimmies, as they would say. And with regards to Trump, he doesn't need, for example, all of the other presidents. Generally, supposedly Bill Clinton finished completely broke because his entire time in office he was fighting lawsuits from different women that he fucked or raped or, you know, whatnot. And, you know, supposedly he finished broke. Barack Obama, he doesn't really have so much money. So these guys have got to toe the line in with regards to whatever their corporate and banking masters tell them, where Trump doesn't. The guy's a billionaire. He doesn't have to. He could just do whatever the fuck he wants, right? So I don't think he has to really toe any line, because he's already so independent of the system. And the fact that he was able to defeat, he not only defeated the media, he not only defeated the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton, he not only defeated, you know, the Bush, there was the two political dynasties that were forming with the Bushes and the Clintons. He knocked out Jeb in the primaries. He knocked out Clinton in the general. He also knocked out the Republican Party. They went against him too. Paul Ryan, you know, the Speaker of the House. He totally fucking threw him under the bus. So he defeated fucking everybody. Sorry, I'm getting a bit excited. I'm swearing. He defeated everyone, and he doesn't. He's not beholden to anyone. He doesn't owe anyone anything. So yeah, man, he could absolutely go to the right, and I think he'd probably have to do it in a second term, though. It depends on his popularity ratings come toward the first general after his first term.
Okay, here's a good question. This is from Woz Lee. I think I've heard of him before.
Yeah, I know him.
Right. Okay. Okay. Which sources do you trust? And how do you approach validating and verifying them?
Generally, what I will trust is what are generally considered acceptable media, things like The Economist, The New York Times, these kinds of things. And another thing I trust are university studies that are peer-reviewed. So if I find something, for example, you know, I was making a video recently. I don't trust blogs. But it's not that I trust the mainstream media either. The one thing is that generally what I will do is go to what are considered legitimate legacy media outlets plus peer-reviewed university sources. I don't trust just random things you read on the internet.
Okay. Are there any Western countries that you believe are too far gone and incapable of saving or reversing policies?
Sweden and Canada, both of them. I think Sweden is going to be the first. Sweden is going to be the first Western country to fall. Sweden is not recoverable. Even the guy I told you is my friend, and we've been friends for years and years and years. Even though he doesn't agree with everything, he's exceedingly meek in his responses to anything. He'd rather just not get involved, not think about it, not talk about it, even though he's watching. He lives just outside of Malmo, between Malmo and Lund, in a little small village. So he's living, I mean, he's outside of it, but I mean, he's a 10-minute train ride into the belly of the beast, and still, you know, and he's got two kids, and he's still not at all active in trying to reverse what's happening. So, and he's friends with me, you know, and he has to listen to me and my opinion. So, I mean, if this guy is not, you know, capable of changing, and if this guy is not capable of even, you know, voicing an opinion toward it, no, Sweden is done and Canada is done. Both of them for the same reasons. The people are too ideologically and too demographically far gone at this point, I think.
Hmm. Okay, this is quite an abrasive question.
Sure.
You recently posted a video denouncing atheism and saying that religion was the answer.
Okay, is that the end of the question?
No, no. Do you admit that this was at least a careless form of words, as what you were arguing for was a particular form of Christianity?
Okay.
And even in the video, you said that Islam was a major problem that you wanted to guard against.
Okay, I didn't make a video against atheism. That's not what I did. I made a video describing the hole that irreligiousness leaves within a society. It wasn't advocating for Christianity either. See, this is the thing. I sometimes think that you know, some people get the videos I make and some people don't. I mean, it's just the video was basically describing, and I was very careful in the very beginning of the video to describe why atheists don't believe in God. It's a hard concept or a hard pill to swallow. But what I did talk about is the hole that the lack of religiousness leaves within a society, and that atheism does not offer any alternative. All it does is create a vacuum fucking black hole within society that's being filled with feminism, multiculturalism, and Islam. All three of these things are poisonous to the body of Western society. So the idea that atheism is inherently bad or is denouncing it, I didn't denounce atheism. What I said was that we as a species are hardwired to believe in something greater than ourselves. It's a simple fact. There's no society that's ever existed that was entirely atheist, other than, you know, people will say, oh, well, the communists were atheists in Russia. No, they weren't. It was forced atheism on a people. But once communism fell, everybody went back to their churches and their mosques. So it's not a denunciation of atheism in any way, shape, or form. It's saying that when you remove religion without providing any kind of substitute other than ridiculing the religious, you're leaving a fucking hole that's going to be filled with a lot of bad things. It's a vacuum, and you see it right now. For example, Sweden's a very good example. I think I read the comment on there, somebody saying, well, we in Sweden, we're not religious, but, you know, we're like one of the best countries in the world. And yeah, look what's happening to you in Sweden. You know, look what's happening to your country. You're not, if there's going to be a transition from, for example, in Christianity, what I was talking about with Christianity is Christianity has been in the West, you know, in some parts for, you know, 1400 years, some parts, you know, 900 years, but it's for about 1,000 years. And that Christianity is integral with the history of the Western people in the art, in the architecture, in the music, in the philosophy, in every aspect of Western society. Christianity has evolved with it in tandem. And the fact that Western society has Christianity as its basis, it was the reason I brought it up. Not the fact that somehow atheism is, you know, bad or I was denouncing it, if that clears it up.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, you're talking about the social result of atheism rather than atheism itself.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not atheism itself. I mean, I don't care what anyone believes. I'm just saying that once you introduce and try, the thing about it is not, the thing about atheism is the idea that you don't believe in anything. Fine. But that's not what atheism in the West is doing anymore. All atheism does as if you say, well, it's not an ideology. Yes, it is, because it's an ideology of ridicule and denunciation and nihilism. Exactly. And I think I used that word in my video. It was nihilism. And the thing is if you're just going to continually browbeat people, telling them that they're fucking stupid because they believe in a prime mover, but then offer them no alternative other than nihilism, I mean, how does that affect society? So yeah, it's not atheism itself. It's the effect of introducing atheism into a society with no alternatives.
Okay.
Take a look at most atheists. Most atheists you'll meet are going to be large, like, leftists. They're going to be large believers in feminism, in multiculturalism, and in a lot of these tactics and these philosophies and these ideologies that are poisonous to any society that introduces them to the into the society.
Mm. I agree. I mean,
and then I'm just gonna comment on somebody's ninja. He says the alternative is reason, logic, and something other. I'm just looking at the chat. Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. Reason, logic, and understanding. That's fine. This is the argument. Yes, of course. But 99% of people aren't like that. Reason and logic, yeah, that's fine, but it doesn't work. It doesn't work on a societal level, and it you can have it at a personal level. And the thing is, what will happen is, even if you go to like these atheist sites, they always use as their icon a brain. So, like, if you're an atheist, somehow you're smarter than other people. You know, it's this idea that I am a reasonable, logical, intelligent person. And therefore, this is what society should. Society works on tits, beer, and hamburgers, and fast motor cars. I mean, people aren't these you know, liberal, intelligent creatures. We're monkeys. We're fucking naked monkeys. You know, that's what we are.
Okay. So I think you've answered that one. So what region or country do you think would be best to go to once the situation in the West has hit critical mass? Eastern Europe? Do you think people should even consider leaving? Should we try to group together and establish communes or some other kind of organizations instead of leaving the West?
It's a hard question because it depends on how things evolve. Because right now, as you were saying earlier, the institutions are against us, and more than 50% of your fellow countrymen are against you. So why save a country that doesn't want to be saved? It depends on how things evolve and how things change. Because the biggest enemy that people have in their own country is their fellow countrymen, right? So one of the first people that made a response video to me was this little nincompoop called Libertarian Socialist Rants. He's this pimply ideological ideal.
He's Scottish. Yeah.
Exactly. That's what I was. Yeah. He's Scottish, but he is perhaps one of the most mentally, he's obviously got himself a thinking brain. He's not stupid. He's articulate, but his ideology is so mixed up with retardation. And he comes from the same country as you. So are you going to try to save that guy from himself while he's fighting you when you're doing it? People always say, oh, you're a cuck if you leave, you know, but the thing is you're trying to, like, I used him as an example because you're both Scottish, right? And this guy, I mean, he probably would love taking, you know, 9 inches of cock up his ass from Jerome and Tyrone and Panjit and Muhammad, everybody. And he'd say, thank you. And he say, "I'm sorry if it wasn't good enough while you did it." And
he's not here to defend himself, but
no, of course. But I'm using that as an example.
I know.
The idea is that are you going to try to save him from himself, right? So, and the second part of the question is if you're going to go somewhere, I think probably South America, the three countries, Uruguay, Chile, and Argentina are probably going to be the last line of defense of the Western world. Nobody really characterizes them as part of the Western world now. But I think those three countries will probably be the end of the line.
Okay. What's the next one? Hold on a second. Oh yeah. Any thoughts on the Conservative Party of Canada leadership question? I can't imagine Trudeau getting another term. Who would make a good replacement in your opinion?
In Canada, there is no good replacement. All of the parties, I mean, the Conservative Party is conservative in name only. Stephen Harper, who was Prime Minister for close to a decade, if not more, never oversaw any kind of conservative agenda. I mean, immigration never was reduced, whether in good times or bad times. I think Canada's political establishment, as I told you, the two countries that are circling the drain at the highest velocity are Canada and Sweden. There is nobody. There's nobody who is electable that will alter the trajectory that Canada's on.
Right. Okay. I mean, I would say similar things in about Britain. Mm. Okay. All right. What do you think of Turkey, aka Ottoman Empire II, and President Erdogan? aka Sultan Erdogan, and their bid to join the EU?
Well, I actually had the fortune of living in Istanbul for more than a year when I was younger. And so I have a lot of affection toward the country. It's a very bizarre country because the western part of Anatolia, you have people that are basically, they're just like Greeks. They're not religious. They drink beer. The girls wear miniskirts. You know, they fool around with you. You can get a girlfriend there and play around as you would in any European city. So I have an affection for Turkey. With regards to Erdogan and the joining of the EU, it's basically a backdoor, because what you do is you're moving the borders of Europe to Iraq, Syria, and Iran. And basically it's a backdoor invitation for demographic colonization of the Middle East of Europe. It would be as we said before, I don't see the EU lasting. It's lost all legitimacy. But let's just say it did last, and Turkey was allowed ascension into the EU, Europe would be finished. It would be done. And he is trying to play the Ottoman Sultan Empire card, you know, 2.0. And in a lot of respects, I think he's doing a very good job for his own country. The problem is he's basically reverting the country and, you know, going against a lot of the reforms that Ataturk made after the First World War, when he was and turned Turkey into a secular country and, you know, changed the alphabet, you know, got rid of the Fez and all of these things. So he obviously loves his country, but he also is an Islamist. So he's good for maybe his country, maybe not for the secular people of his country, but he's a menace. And Turkey is a menace to Europe.
Right. Okay. What is your view on libertarian politics? If people can understand the basics of libertarianism, do you think they would be able to better understand the freedoms that multiculturalism takes away from the country?
Probably. I mean, libertarianism, like any ideology, has its pluses and benefits. And I think if people did understand the ideas of you can't, but the thing is, libertarianism can't exist in a multicultural environment. The reason being is, once you import all kinds of different groups, you're going to have something on top of those groups, forcing them to try to get along with one another. You see this in the UK. Like we were talking earlier about the new laws controlling any kind of objection to stereotypes of Jewish people, or all of that. Everything now in the UK is a hate crime. If you argue against allowing the importation of migrants into your small Scottish island village, that will completely subsume your local population, that's a hate crime. Libertarianism would only ever really work within a very homogenous and very like-minded group of people that all subscribe to it. And yes, if you could give the tenets of libertarianism and have people understand them, you might be able to, but you'd also have to have that group of people be a group that is homogeneous in thinking, homogeneous in ideology, and homogeneous in desire for similar lifestyles. And it's basically the absolute opposite of multiculturalism.
Right. Okay. Because of course multiculturalism celebrates diversity.
Yep.
But the more general. Okay. Would you ever move to Eastern Europe?
I like Eastern Europe very much. One of my favorite countries I've ever been to is Hungary. And one of my very good friends, he's from the Czech Republic. He's Canadian. Well, he lives in Canada now. But I would not choose to move to Eastern Europe for a few reasons, but no, I wouldn't. I'd like to visit it, but I'd never want to live there.
Okay. There's a guy who's quite skeptical of your experiences of Canada. He says, you keep talking about things in Canada that I'm not seeing. You say Canada is doomed, but the biggest Muslim town that I'm aware of is London, Ontario, and they're only at 4% Muslim. how much real experience with Canada as a country do you actually have?
I've been to every single province in Canada. One of my jobs brought me to when I was younger. I've been to every province except for I've been to the Northwest Territory and the two territories, but they've cut the Northwest Territories into a new territory, Nunavut. So I haven't been to that new cut up territory, but I've been to all of the provinces. The thing is Canada is made by its major cities. So if you're talking, you're from a small town, yeah, fine. Obviously, you're not going to see that. But if you have been to any of the large cities in Canada, whether it's Vancouver, Calgary, whether it's Toronto, Montreal, Ottawa, any of these kind of places, and even small towns like Newfoundland, like St. John's. St. John's is now becoming a destination for Canada is receiving. They're looking at upping. Canada had a population 10 years. They're adding basically of immigrants, 250,000 to 300,000 per year, plus refugees, plus family reunification into a country that 10 years ago had 20 million people. So what you have is unbelievable. So for example, by 20, I actually just saw it for a video I was making, by 2030, so less than 15 years from now, one out of three Canadians, quote unquote Canadians, one out of three Canadians will be foreign born. So you've got, and that's not including the other, the people that were born to foreign parents. So yes, experience in Canada, I've been right across the country. Yes, Canada is made up of thousands of small little towns that aren't being affected. And that if you're living in one of these towns that are outside the major metropolitan areas, you might not feel it. But if you go to anything over 250,000, 300,000 people sized town, yeah, it's happening. I have a photograph of myself. I went to an elementary school in a suburb of Vancouver called Richmond. And when I went there, I've got my school photo. I'm just looking at it right now. There's two Chinese kids in that photograph of 20 kids. Everybody else is Canadian. And that suburb now, Richmond, is the street signs are in Chinese now. I don't even know what the population of the school would be, but I'd probably venture to guess there might be maybe one European kid in that school. So, yes, you can be skeptical of it, but yeah, I have traveled the width and breadth of Canada, so I have a pretty good,
okay.
At least in my own opinion, I have a pretty good idea.
Okay. Related to a previous question on religion, I saw in your video that you talked about rituals in Japan. Mm-hmm. But the way I see it, rituals are like the bones that form from living religions. When you only have the rituals, you have a corpse. Do you think we could find spirituality and a sense of the sacred in anything we actually believe in this post-scientific and tech revolution mindset, besides that new age cheap crap that mixes quantum theory with magic? I think this new sacred will form around values that we might now take for granted, but which will appear to us as holy in the hard times to come.
I agree to a certain extent, but I think the hard times that are coming is going to require... it's going to require unification around something. And if that something is values that we will ascribe to holy, so be it. I don't believe that human beings can rally around ideas only. There has to be an agent that is larger than themselves. And it's just part of what we are. I would like to think that I like the way he described, you know, the union of, you know, quantum theory and magic. I mean, it's pretty much what it is right now. I mean, people are talking about, you know, we're living within a hologram. There's a really good book that I read called Biocentrism, and it talks about the idea that consciousness creates matter rather than the other way around. And it makes a lot of sense to me. And it actually makes a lot more sense to me than religion or your standard scientific interpretation of what the reality in which we live in, which we don't understand at all. The problem with that is that it's not something I would ever give my life for. It's not something I would ever, you know, give my children's life for. It's not something I would ever want my wife to die for. And that is the difference between faith and ideas, I guess. So I think that Western people are going to either have to re-find their faith, or they're going to have a new faith thrust upon them, and that faith is probably going to be Islam.
Right, that's rather ominous. Okay, two other questions. Do you think there will be a migrant backlash in Europe or America due to an economic depression in the next 15 years?
I could see it happening. I don't know. It's really hard to say. The United States, I think, is geographically so spread out that, you know, most of the migrants that you see, like, I mean, it's becoming a lot of the migrants. You could go, for example, from, you know, Spokane, Washington, all the way over to Green Bay, Wisconsin, and everyone there is white. You know, it's a huge swath, or into New England. And when you don't have that, there's no reason for the backlash. If there was going to be a backlash, I think it would have probably happened in Europe, because over there, people live in much closer quarters. You don't have the ability to geographically separate yourself the way they do in the United States. So if there is going to be a backlash, I think it will probably happen in Europe more than it would in the United States, because Americans, if they don't like something, they can just move away and they can separate themselves. I mean, it's just a matter of geography. Whereas, you know, when you go to the UK, I mean, one thing I remember going to visit my grandmother and some of my family in the UK is that, not my grandmother. she's passed away. Some of my friends in the UK, their houses were just, they're like rabbit hutches. They're so small and they're just so crowded together. And you can't drive an hour anywhere in the UK without running into some sort of form of civilization, some sort of town, some kind of petrol station, anything. You can't drive an hour in the UK without finding something. And because of that, and because of all of the enrichment, as I like to call it, flooding into Europe, it's going to happen there. It's not going to happen in the US.
Right. Okay.
Also, one other thing I'd like to add about that is the people that are arriving in the United States, for the majority of them, I mean, it's Latin Americans. And Latin Americans, while being different somewhat culturally, they still are Christians. So their cultural background is not as alien, or specifically not as antagonistic.
Yeah. Okay. But I think what the question, just to get back to it, was do you think there will be a migrant backlash in Europe or America due to an economic depression in the next
due to an
years?
Economic depression? Well, I don't see how there's not going to be some kind of economic problems, just given the fact that the baby boom generation is reaching its peak right now. The draws on society via taxation and redistribution are massive, and then you have all of these people coming in. So yeah, I could see economic problems being maybe the spark that lights the candle of backlashes toward migrants in Europe. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Because it will only come when people have the only time people will ever act out is when they have less to lose than they have to gain. So the only time people will ever risk something is that when they have nothing to lose. And that generally is when people are, this is why nothing's happening in places like Europe right now, where you can have thousands of little girls defiled by Muslims, is because they don't want to lose their job and their comfort.
Yeah, for sure.
By speaking out. Right?
I mean, it's a very real thing. You know, it would be great if people had the bigger context in mind, and they were talking about if they saw themselves as protectors of Western civilization and their peoples and so on. But the truth is, most people are very concerned with the here and now in the next 5 years, and they don't want to lose their jobs. I mean, it's
exactly. And it's funny how speaking out about things that are very, very, very bad for your society is penalized now through you. And this is the thing you have on the left. What they want to do is they call it name and shame. It's not that. They want to silence you via taking away your ability to feed yourself.
Yeah. It's really disgusting.
It's fucking totalitarianism. It's fucking disgusting. And I don't swear very often. I don't swear at all. And my wife's not here, so it's okay. But, and I will use it. Fuck it. It's fucking disgusting. And to take away somebody's fucking ability to feed themselves because you disagree with their ideas, it's fucking totalitarian. It's evil.
Mm. Okay. There was one other. Ah, yes, this one. Do you see Canada having a British renaissance in its culture, or do you think it will be more pan-European? I see pan-European movements as the initial stages of multiculturalism.
No. I don't see a renaissance, no.
Or even pan-European in Canada?
No, I don't. I don't. I just don't see it. The thing is that the cities have too much power over the rural areas, I see, and most people living in rural areas are content with their lives that they live. They're content with going hunting, fishing, driving around to their favorite swimming hole when it's not snowing. I guess ice fishing is what they do in the winter, and things that with regards to cultural or renaissance or even considering these things generally happen in cities, and the cities in Canada are gone. So yeah.
Mm.
I don't see it.
Okay. All right then. I think that's them all. There were other questions, but I know that Black Pigeon Speaks wouldn't want to answer them. So, or they're duplicates of other questions. So I'm not going to ask them. Here's one. Here's another one. All right. No, I don't know. I think that's a bit dangerous. I'm not going to ask that one. All right. So I think that's it then. This is, I don't know how long we've been going. Is it about 3 hours now?
I'm not sure, man. Like I told you, like I started off still a bit drunk this morning.
So, I hope this has sobered you up.
Yeah, it has. I mean, I've had, you know, four cans of soda water. So yeah.
Okay. All right, well, thanks very much for doing this. I think I hope people have enjoyed this. I think it's been a very interesting hangout, very interesting discussion. So hopefully we'll have you on again next year. That would be good.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I look forward to it.
Hopefully we've still got our channels this time next year.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
All right, then. Well, thanks to Black Pigeon Speaks. Thanks to everyone for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this. The next one, tomorrow night, it's Reality Calls, then the Duke of Durham, and then Athena. So, see you then. Thanks for listening.